All right. Well, you would turn over to 2 Kings chapter 14. Try to cover a good amount of verses today and kind of get this whole story all together, because we've kind of got an intersection of north and south here between Israel and Judah in these verses. And it's kind of we're going to see a little bit of some infighting between the two kingdoms. And then it's kind of the last good time, really, for both nations, especially for Israel, but even so for Judah, the last time of real prosperity before Assyria shows up in about 60 years. And then, you know, prosperity kind of goes out the window, especially for Israel, when the Assyrians show up. So here's our two kings. Okay, I kind of pictured them like two brothers fighting each other. One is certainly an older brother because he's much stronger than the other. But that doesn't stop brothers from fighting. You know, even though the little brother gets the butt kicked, he still wants to fight his older brother. And so both of these nations at this point, both Israel and Judah, are on a high point. Remember, last week Judah was on a low point. Right? They were down to just about nothing as far as their army went. Well, they've rebuilt that back up under Amaziah. Remember, he replaced his father, and he is going to build it back up, and he's going to get some military successes. Meanwhile, in Israel, if you remember from Elisha's prophecies, you know, the whole shoot the arrow out the window and you'll triumph over Syria, and then hit the arrows into the ground, and he does it three times. So God promises Israel three victories over Syria. All that's going on. And so Syria is kind of subdued. Assyria had established itself. Now they've kind of retreated a little bit. They'll be coming back again, like I said, in about 50, 60 years. But things are kind of calm up north. So Israel is as strong as it's been since Ahab. And Judah is back on to at least being a respectable military force again. And so because of the weakness of nations around them, they probably look a little stronger than they actually are, especially Judah. And so they basically use this freedom, this time of peace, this time where they shouldn't have to worry about outside forces, and they start fighting each other. You know, not the most productive thing for these two nations. So let's read our first seven verses of our section. In the second year of Joash, the son of Jehoaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoadin of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, yet not like David his father. He did in all things as Joash his father had done, but the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. And as soon as the royal power was firmly in his hand, he struck down his servants who had struck down the king, his father. But he did not put to death the children of the murderers, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, where the Lord commanded, fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor shall children be put to death because of their fathers, but each one shall die for his own sin. Right. So we see a little bit of a kind of an inconsistency here with Amaziah. Okay. On one sense, he's obedient to the Mosaic law, and he doesn't kill the sons of the murderers because of what is written in the Mosaic law. And he does what is right in the eyes of the Lord, and yet he doesn't do everything right in the eyes of the Lord. He doesn't get rid of the high places like most of these kings fail to do. And then there are times when he is very much obedient to the law and times when he's very disobedient to the law. He seems to be a mixture of good and bad, but at least tilting towards the good side there. It also shows you that he probably doesn't have anything to do with his father's death, because he does put the murderers of his father to death. And the next king, what we see later on, doesn't do that. So there may be a suggestion that he may have been involved in the murder of his father. So we don't have any confirmation, but it seems like if he was involved, unless he's really dastardly, but then why would the author here call him a good king? If he was really involved in the murder and he killed all those guys to cover it up, I don't know that they could call him a good king. So he probably wasn't involved. Okay, so here's Amaziah, just a quick rundown. It appears he had nothing to do with his father's assassination. His reign lasts about 29 years. Based on your timeline, we're at about 796 to about 767 B.C. He's not as faithful as David. He's considered better spiritually than most of Judah's kings. And on one hand, he obeys Moses' law, but on the other hand, he doesn't keep all of Moses' law. So he's kind of that. He's kind of just a mediocre, middle of the road sort of king. Okay? And his greatest military achievement comes in verse 7. Okay? And verse 7 says,
he struck down 10,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt and took Selah by storm and called it Jokthiel, which is its name to this day. That's really all we get. Not a lot of detail there, but it's a victory over Edom, right? And who's Edom again from way back?
Esau.
Yeah, those are the descendants of Esau. They live on our map. I think I've got a map coming up, but they're down here. Okay, there's Edom right there. They sit right down here. Dead Sea's right here on this side of the Jordan. Okay, so onto the southern end of Judah, and that's where you would run into Edom. And we don't really know how big of a victory this is. Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
Okay, back in verse 6, where did they get the idea that someone should die for the crime of his family member?
There are definitely certain cases where, like, remember Jehu killed all of Ahab's family and all of his descendants. Like, for example, Achan at Jericho with his sin, he's killed and his entire family is killed. And later on in, it's in Deuteronomy 26, 27, it's somewhere in there, and I think it's in Leviticus as well. Moses makes a pronouncement that the sin of the man will be punished, not his family, and vice versa. And so it's a pronouncement that Moses makes moving forward as they go towards the promised land, that only the man will be held guilty for his sin, not his family. So
I'm sure that prior to the law,
yes,
I mean, the whole families were being put to death, put to a sword all the time,
yeah,
to make sure that there wasn't somebody to come back.
Avenger and all that. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's where it comes from. So, again, we don't know how big this is. It's not possible to say with certainty where the battle even took place. We don't have these cities anymore. But it's certain that Judah expands the border. Okay, Judah gets bigger, gets more powerful. And then we get a little more detail here about what goes on in 2 Chronicles 25. So if you want to flip over there, I'll have it on the screen too, but it's a little small. So when we go 2 Chronicles 25, 26, we'll be going back over there a few times. So if you want to kind of put a little bookmark in there so you can flip back and forth, the Chronicles gives us a little more specific detail about what's going on here in the Kings. So it says in Chronicles, "Then Amaziah assembled the men of Judah and set them by fathers' houses under commanders of thousands and of hundreds for all Judah and Benjamin. He mustered those 20 years old and upward and found that they were 300,000 choice men, fit for war, able to handle spear and shield. He hired also 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel for 100 talents of silver." So let's just get the picture here. He's got his own army. He wanted to bolster that army, so he hired mercenaries from Israel and paid them to come fight. Okay, so an extra 100,000 guys from Israel that are getting paid to come down here and fight in this battle. Okay, now verse 7. "But a man of God came to him and said, O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel with all these Ephraimites." So he gets a word from a prophet, send those guys home. "But go, act, be strong for the battle. Why should you suppose that God will cast you down before the enemy? For God has power to help or cast down." And Amaziah said to the man of God, "But what shall we do about the 100 talents that I've given to the army of Israel? I already paid these guys. What do you want me to do?" And the man of God answered, The Lord is able to give you much more than this. Don't worry about it. The Lord will take care of it. Verse 10, "Then Amaziah discharged the army that had come from Ephraim to go home again, and they became very angry with Judah and returned home in fierce anger." So these mercenaries, you know, you think you got some money, you'd be okay. But I guess these guys were spoiling for a fight, and now they're just really irritated. They're going to fight somebody. So in verse 11, "Amaziah took courage and led out his people and went to the Valley of Salt and struck down 10,000 men of Seir. And the men of Judah captured another 10,000 alive and took them to the top of the rock and threw them down from the top of the rock, and they were all dashed to pieces." Nice, happy family story this morning. "But the men of the army whom Amaziah sent back, not letting them go with him to battle, raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon and struck down 3,000 people in them and took much spoil." So the mercenaries on their way back north took a little bit extra with them. Okay? They felt insulted. They felt disrespected. They felt, you know, left out, whatever it is. And they destroyed Judahite cities, and they took spoil with them, and they killed 3,000 people. Okay? So after this great victory in Edom, Judah's going to come back and find out this is what these mercenaries have done. And this is what's going to provoke the fight between the two nations. Okay, so they take out their frustrations after being dismissed. Their actions coupled with Amaziah's pride lead to a confrontation. So just so you've got an idea here, here's Jerusalem as they head back north. Samaria's here. Beth Horon's up here. It's a northern pass into Jerusalem. So they just kind of go up through this land and and wreck shop a little bit and take stuff for their own. Okay, so Amaziah's got a challenge here in verse 8. Okay, and then Jehoash is going to respond to him. Okay, so 14:8 says, "Then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, 'Come, let us look one another in the face.'" They were a lot more proper back those days, but, you know, put your own kind of thing there. But let's have a little talk, all right? "I'll meet you after school out by the oak tree." Like, that's kind of what we've got going on here, okay? And so Jehoash gets the message up there in Israel, and he responds. "Jehoash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah, 'A thistle on Lebanon sent to a cedar on Lebanon, saying, Give your daughter to my son for a wife. And a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle. You have indeed struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Be content with your glory and stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble so that you fall, you and Judah with you?" You're a little thistle. I'm a big cedar tree. You might want to stay home. Hey, this is not the best idea for you. You got a nice little victory down there over Edom. You know, feel good about yourself and stay home in glory in that. But you really don't want this fight. Okay? It's kind of an interesting idea here. So this is kind of the fight, right? I just thought it was a great picture. So Jehoash is clearly... You get a, I don't know. It just comes up in random search. I didn't search the thing in Edward Scissorhands playing rock, paper, scissors. It was like, I don't know what I searched, but that's what came up. I think it was unfair fight or something is what I was looking for, and that's what came up. Okay. So clearly Jehoash is the Lebanon cedar. Amaziah is the lowly thistle that's trampled by a passing animal. Israel doesn't really want to fight. You know, Israel's not looking for a fight, but he kind of makes it clear. But if you want to bring it, then bad things are going to happen to you. Okay, so I kind of pictured this, you know, that Israel is Doc Holliday in this illustration. Okay, he's the Huckleberry, and it's fine. If you want to fight, we can fight. Yeah? I won't start it, but I'll finish it if you want to bring it up here. And that's exactly what's going to happen. Okay, so let's look at 11 through 14. "But Amaziah would not listen. His pride gets in the way. Okay? He's going to go up and take care of business. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another in battle at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his home. And Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh, and came to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem for 400 cubits from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. And he seized all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, also hostages, and he returned to Samaria." Hey, this is a pretty decisive victory. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I got to go back to the way Amaziah couched his letter, if you will, his missive to Israel, when he said, let's go face to face. Is that a euphemism, apparently, for let's do better?
I think so. That's one of the, a lot of the commentators said this was like a, it was a typical entreaty between kings. Yeah.
Okay. Is when I first read it, I thought,
doesn't sound like a fight. Yeah.
We need to talk about your people.
Yeah.
I don't want to come after them. I want you to deal with your people that did this.
Yeah.
No, it's a whole different dynamic going on.
Yes.
Than what I thought.
Yeah, because it says Amaziah didn't listen. You know, apparently this was, he was going to fight, and Israel says, Jehoash says, you don't want to do this, and Amaziah did it anyway, and look what happens to him. And you can imagine Amaziah now, his standing in Judah, after he started a fight, and not only did he lose, but they came into Jerusalem, they knocked down a big section of the wall, they took a bunch of gold and silver out of the city and out of the temple. This is pretty much the end of Amaziah's credibility as a king in the south, because he really overstepped his bounds here. Beating Edom and beating Israel were two very different things.
I am a little confused, because didn't the Lord tell him to, you know, send away those soldiers,
yeah,
and that he was going to give him more than, you know, the 100,000 times 100 that's, you know, so that's 10 million or whatever. I mean, that's...
So it sounds like the man of God is not exactly God right.
Well, he doesn't tell him to go challenge Israel to a fight.
At the very beginning, though, remember, he says, just let it go, you know, dismiss those guys, let them go home. And it sounds like it backfired.
Yeah.
So it sounds like...
We don't know who this man of God is, so they, you know...
It doesn't say.
Yeah.
Okay.
they call him a man of God.
They call him a man of God.
The point being, if he had not challenged Israel, if he had just
waited
a little bit and see what the Lord had in mind, maybe he would have been prosperous.
Yeah, I think because God is still protecting Israel, despite Israel's total depravity up there, and when we talk about it with Elisha and stuff, he's continually blessing wicked kings over and over and over again in Israel. And so I don't know that there's any way that God would be okay with Judah fighting Israel. And they're still technically brothers. You know, I think maybe that's what turns the tables on it a little bit. Is that
God's out isn't our own option. God's continuing to bless our wickedness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got great things in store for you. You know, stay hanging in with me.
We tend to do the wrong thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. All right. And here's what I thought. You know, it's Proverbs 16:18. You know, pride goes before destruction. I got that. I already beat him. I'm going to go up there and make a name for myself. I'm going to be the greater kingdom. And look what happens to him. Just as Jehoash predicts, the confrontation proves disastrous for Judah. Jehoash told him, "You don't want to do this. You're going to lose if you come and fight me. But if you provoke me, I will take you out." And that's exactly what happens. And again, the chronicler is going to give us a little more insight here. And I didn't want to read the whole thing, but just a couple of verses there in 2 Chronicles 25. It says, "After Amaziah came from striking down the Edomites, he brought the gods of the men of Seir and set them up as his gods and worshipped them, making offerings to them." So when not only did he defeat Edom, he brought pagan gods back with him, which was a Near East kind of thing. When you conquered other nations, you took their gods, you took possession. Israel was not supposed to do that. Judah was not supposed to do that. But the king of Judah does that. And then in verse 20, further down, "But Amaziah would not listen, for it was of God, in order that he might give them into the hand of their enemies, because they had sought the gods of Edom." So why does Amaziah get smashed by Jehoaz in Israel? Because he brought pagan gods back with him from Edom. He did not. That, obviously, the man of God did tell him to do that. And this is what the chronicler says. This is why he lost that battle so decisively, because he decided to worship other gods. All right. So just a little geography lesson again. This is the Shvelah. I just love the word. I just like saying it. Just walk around all day saying Shvelah. The geography is here in Israel is you've got a coastal plain, right? And here's Jerusalem, right thereabouts. It's on a central mountain ridge route, right? You always go up to Jerusalem because you got to go up the mountain. Well, in between the coastal plain and the central ridge route is this group of footholds called the Shvelah. Okay? And there are four passes. You can't just, like, if you lived over here, you can't just attack Jerusalem from this direction. It's just not going to work. It's straight uphill. You can't take an army up there. Okay? You've got to come up the ridge route and attack Jerusalem from the north. Okay? It's the only way you can do it, because it's the only accessible way to get to Jerusalem where you're going to get an army up there. Okay? And there are four passes through the Shvelah that you would take your army up. Okay? I know we're in nerdy territory, but hang with me. Okay? That you would take your army up. And there are four guardian cities on each pass. So you have to get through the guardian city before you can move on up the pass. And really, if you really want to seize Jerusalem, which is what we'll see Assyria do later on, you've got to take out all four. Because if you manage to get up one, they can swing around behind you and close you in. And you've got to basically take it out piece by piece. Okay? So Lachish is down here. That's the furthest south. That'll take you up to Hebron. And then you would go north to Jerusalem. Azekah, the Elah Valley, that's where David fought Goliath, in the Valley of Elah. Okay? Azekah leads you up to Bethlehem, and then you would go up north to Jerusalem. Beit Shemesh takes you right up to Jerusalem, most direct route, but it's also the most vertical route. And then Gezer guards the Ajalon Valley, which takes you up to the north central ridge route where you could come in from the north. Well, this is where the battle takes place for between Israel and Judah. At Beth Shemesh. And they're going to go right up here north and they're going to attack the city. They're not looking to stay. So they don't have to go and take out all these different places. But it's a short little 15-mile hike up the mountain to get to Jerusalem. So once they defeat Judah at Beth Shemesh, Jerusalem is vulnerable. And that's how they're able to get there and take them out. Make sense? You with me? All right. Thanks for indulging. Okay, so Israel attacks the Beit Shemesh, 50 miles southwest of Jerusalem. It's an important city for commerce. A lot of trade goes through there, so it tells you that maybe that's a strategic choice by Jehoaz to take a little bit of economy here, too, because he's going to take the king back with him. So you get the idea that Israel's kind of running Judah for a little while, at least partially. So they march 50 miles to the holy city. They rout Judah's army. They capture Amaziah. They take Jerusalem. They break down portions of the city walls, and they plunder the temple and the palace. And hostages are taken, which by all accounts is kind of out of the ordinary. The Israel and Judah rarely took hostages. And so this is kind of serious. Yeah, I think it more just adds to the humiliation of the king. And not only is he defeated, but he's captured and taken out of the land. Maybe it's a little bit of foreshadowing for what's going to happen later on. Right? So complete humiliation. It seems like that's about the section of the wall that gets taken down. Remember, this is the old city wall. City of David's down here. The palace is up here. And then you've got the Temple Mount. That's today the wall comes all the way up here. Okay, this is the old city gates. So it seems like this side of the wall is what's taken down on the north side, which is exactly where they would have come in if they would have attacked from Beit Shemesh. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, so real quick, we don't have to spend time on these, but here goes the end of Jehoash. We actually heard his rundown earlier at the end of chapter 13, but this is just kind of a reintroduction and re-say when he died. But the rest of the acts of Jehoash that he did and his might and how he fought with Amaziah, king of Judah, are not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And Jehoash slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel, and Jeroboam his son reigned in his place. So now he is going to be replaced by Jeroboam the second. And not a great guy to be named after, and he's not much better than his great-great-great-great-whatever grandfather. Okay, so let's get to the next section, starting in 17. All right. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Jehoash, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. Now the rest of the deeds of Amaziah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem. And he fled to Lachish, that was one of the guardian cities. But they sent after him to Lachish and put him to death there. And they brought him on horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his fathers in the city of David. And all the people of Judah took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father Amaziah. He built Elath and restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. Okay, so it does not end well for Amaziah. Like I said, after that he's taken into captive. He's obviously brought back at some point. But his own people turn against him, and he has to flee Jerusalem to live in a neighboring city in Lachish, where they eventually send more people after him, kill him, bring him back, and bury him, and install his son as king. Okay? So Amaziah outlives his rival, but he doesn't really do anything with those 15 years that he outlives him. And it seems like he doesn't have any sole authority, because his son is Azariah. He's also called Uzziah. And we'll talk a little bit about, if we have time today, on Uzziah. Uzziah is the king that gets leprosy for going into the temple and offering sacrifices, if you remember that story. So Azariah, Uzziah, same guy. Okay? And they're going to be co-regent for about 25 years, and then Uzziah will actually be co-regent on the backside. So Azariah is going to be king, Uzziah. I want to call him Uzziah because it's less complicated with the A's. He's actually going to be king for 52 years. But he's co-regent for the first 25, and he's co-regent for the last 10. So he's got a sole role in the beginning. And the son may have even ascended the throne with his father's blood on his hands, because there's no mention of him not being involved in this, and he gets installed as king. The other one killed all the assassins of his fathers. This guy doesn't. So he might have had something to do with it. We don't know for sure.
So Amaziah was killed by his own people?
His own people, yes.
People from Judah?
Yes. Yeah, they bring him back at some point, and he's killed when they kick him out of Jerusalem, and then somewhere down the line, his own people nicks him and put his son in. Probably wait till his son hits 16.
The reason he was given his throne back is because he promised special cooperation of some sort.
Oh, sure.
To get himself out of Israel.
Yeah.
And the people down the south, we don't want to be back here under those.
Yeah, he has lost all credibility. Yeah. Hey, so that's why I've got these blue. The blue regions are, he was king from 792 until 740. The front side he's sharing with his father. The back side he's sharing with his son, because the back side he's going to have leprosy. And he can't go in the temple or anywhere in the main part of the city, so he has to stay outside. So his son pretty much rules with him. So he expands the south. He restores the port city of Elath, a project his father may have begun. That was something Solomon wanted to do, so he could export stuff all over the world. Okay? In time, he's going to achieve more than his father, in part because he's intelligent enough to realize that war with Israel is pretty counterproductive. He gets along with Israel. And the time of Israel and Judah fighting one another has ended for now. So it was short and sweet, but it was pretty destructive for Judah. Okay? So we've got now, moving on down the line, I've still got a couple of those king cards in my office. I'll bring them next week if y'all want to have a little cheat sheet so you can follow where all the kings are. Gave them to you a long time ago. But if you want one of those, I'll bring them next week so you can kind of keep track of all these dudes, because there's a lot of them. So now we've got Jeroboam the second in Israel and Azariah or Uzziah in Judah. Okay, Jeroboam becomes sole regent of Israel in 782. Israel has only a short time left before its destruction in 722. So if you're a date person, keep 722 in mind, right? That is what we're hurtling towards in Israel because that is exile for Israel. 586 is going to be exile for Judah, although that's about a 20-year-long process. But 722, 586, those are the two dates you want to remember for the exiles. Yes, they'll be on the test. So, Judah also has a time of prosperity under Azariah. Unfortunately, neither nation learns any permanent lessons from their sins. They don't fix the spiritual decay. They keep sinning and keep sinning and keep worshiping the other gods. Okay, so let's try to quickly get through Jeroboam the second. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. He restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, yes, that Jonah, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, for there was none left, bond or free, and there was none to help Israel. But the Lord had not said that he would blot the name of Israel from under heaven, so he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now the rest of Acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he fought and how he restored Damascus and Hamath to Judah and Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jeroboam slept with his fathers, the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, reigned in his place. So another wicked king that is blessed by God because God is still showing mercy, still showing kindness, not willing to blot them out. Again, it's going to show us when the exile finally happens, God can say, hey, I gave you every chance to turn back and you would not do it. Okay, so Jeroboam's second reign is both long, 41 years, and evil. He doesn't go away from the state religion. That's been going on for about 200 years now in Israel. So Yahweh worship has been profaned in Israel for about 200 years. And despite his spiritual condition, the Lord blesses him. He extends Israel's borders to Solomonic levels, all the way up to Damascus. So Israel has control as far north as they ever had. And Solomon was the peak time. They have a presence all the way up into Syria, into Damascus. So it looks really good. And I think that's some of the thing is you see Israel and they don't worship God when they have nothing and they don't worship God when they have everything. You know, they fall apart no matter what. Yeah.
In your last slide, it said that Damascus and Hamath were restored to Judah.
Yeah, there's an interesting, I was reading some of that, and I didn't want to get into it too heavy, but it seems that Israel may have been controlling Judah from that previous battle for a certain number of years, and that the author may be trying to exhibit that when he says that. I don't know, it's confusing, because it does seem to switch back and forth, and I just didn't want to get too deep this morning, but it seems like that may be what's going on. I'm just not sure. It's a weird use of the word, because they say Israel in Judah, which is kind of weird. I don't know what they mean by that. And of course, we get a famous prophet making a cameo here. Hey, Jeroboam restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai. Yep, Jonah and the fish and all that, same guy. He was a prophet to Israel. The Nineveh mission was not his only mission. He was prophesying during this time. So son of Amittai, same Jonah. Okay? And Jonah's not the only active prophet. Hosea is active in Israel right now, and so is Amos. Okay, so I'm going to give you a few selections from them real quick, and we'll probably finish with Jeroboam the second today because we're just about out of time. And so Hosea obviously is the famous story of he marries the prostitute who is going to continually cheat on him and be unfaithful, and he's going to stay with her and bring her back and show God's relationship to Israel. And Amos basically just goes in and says, I've been trying to turn you from sin over and over and over again, and you won't do it. So Hosea says in 1:2, the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord. In 4:1, there's no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. And 4:2, there's swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. So that's during this period in Israel. Amos says, they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Those who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted, a man and his father go into the same girl. How about that? You know, the Bible tells us all these horrible stories. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge, and in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined. So just corrupting worship left and right. And again, it shows us that despite all that, God gives them more chances. God still says, if you would come back to me, I would give you the blessing. And they just won't do it. And when Jeroboam II dies, that's going to be the end of Israel's chances to get this back in the right direction. And Amos gives the consequences here in chapter 7. He says, this is what he showed me. Behold, the Lord was standing beside a wall built with a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. And the Lord said to me, Amos, what do you see? And I said, a plumb line. Then the Lord said, behold, I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will never again pass by them. The high places of Isaac shall be made desolate, and the sanctuaries of Israel shall be laid waste, and I will rise against the house of Jeroboam with the sword. So we're about 20 years out from Assyria showing up and taking the whole place over. And maybe even longer than that, because Jeroboam would have still been alive when Amos said this, at least 20 years before. And he's saying, this is what's going to happen. I will no longer be with Israel. And after these 200 plus years of idolatry and injustice and everything else, God is finally saying, they're going to get kicked out of here. It's done now.
Did I miss something here? High places of Isaac. Have you ever heard of
that? Yeah, it seems to be unique in this in the way Israel puis it. But I'd have to go back and try to see where that would exactly fit in.
I can understand them saying high places of Jacob. Jacob and Israel names, but not Isaac.
Yeah, or even Joseph, because you could be talking about Manasseh and Ephraim and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'll look that up for next week and see if I can find something on that. Yeah, you've piqued my interest too. All right, so that's probably a good place to stop. We'll pick up with Uzziah there in Judah next week, and we're getting close to exile. Get excited. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thanks for this time and your word, and I pray it was productive. Thank you for all that you do for us. Help us to be mindful of you. Help us to understand what it is that you mean to us and what you do for us. And despite our shortcomings and our sins, help us not to lean on those, but to lean on you and to follow you and to chase you and to study you and to do all those things that you command us to do, so we can be your people, be effective followers of you, and make your name famous. Be with us as we go, Lord. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.